You're listening to Justice Radio on WMPG with Rob Ruffner from the Maine Indigent Defense Center. And today we're speaking with Attorney Logan Perkins about the Highland Region's Public Defender Office, the Penobscot County Jail overcrowding, and pretrial service programs in that county. Well, let's first have Attorney Perkins introduce herself and what it's like to lead one of the first public defender regions in the state of Maine.
Good morning, Rob. Thanks for having me, and thanks for that intro. So, Logan Perkins, I am officially the district defender of the Highlands Region Public Defender's Office. We cover and serve the people of Penobscot and Piscataquis counties, and we have been in existence I've been on the job just shy of a year. The office has really only been functioning since we got our furniture and internet. It was no small feat. Back in November of 2024. We have me plus four attorneys in the office currently, although we're hoping to add two more to our roster here in the next couple of months. And we are designed and built to handle about 30% of the indigent criminal defense cases in our district. That's Penobscot and Piscataquis counties or the Highlands region. I've been doing criminal defense work myself for about 13 years. I did take a little sabbatical in there, took a break from practicing law to do some other things and recharge my passion and my heart and my sense of well-being, because the work can be really taxing and can take a toll on us as individuals. So I took a little break in there, but I've been back in this role now for about a year, and so far really enjoying the work of doing this. I think for me, the work of leading this public defender's office creates a good challenge and a good mix of things, from, you know, managing and mentoring other attorneys to thinking about how we can use our sort of collective clout and our percentage of the cases in this county to really shift some policy dynamics in how criminal defense law is practiced in this region.
A brief aside, tell me about the name of your region in your office, because I love it.
Oh, well, thank you. Our CAP agency, our Community Action Partners agency, which are the agencies that came out of the tobacco settlement funds, is called PenQuis. And it's called PenQuis because it's a hybridization or a hyphenation of Penobscot and Piscataquis counties, which are frequently paired together for service provisions. And they also are a single prosecutorial district, which is why our office also has this shape. And so when I came in, the original idea was to call this the PenQuis office. But the problem is that PenQuis CAP has a law project, right? And they provide free legal services to indigent folks in family matters and protection orders. And they do really important work in civil legal aid for low-income folks, but we couldn't take their name. We would have generated mass confusion. And so I started thinking about, how can we name this office in a way that captures the spirit of the region and describes the region accurately without sort of reverting to using words in a language that aren't ours to begin with, or making implications about what's going on here that we don't want to be associated with. And so there are some sort of, I don't know if it's Chamber of Commerce or Tourism Board stuff that are calling this the Highlands region. And that makes sense because we're home to the highest mountain in the state of Maine. Mount Katahdin is in our district. And all of those high level sort of Penobscot River plateau and the highlands that feed the Penobscot River, both here and in Piscataquis County, are the Highlands of Maine. So we have a unique region. We have a river culture here, and we have mountains that feed the river. And so we are a Highlands region.
And I think it gives your office a great tagline or subtitle, you know, Highlands Region, there can be only one. I think officially that whenever your office's title is used, it must be followed immediately by there can be only one.
All right, I'll take that under advisement.
Okay. So, you know, your office's goal in is to be able to be staffed and supported in a way that you can handle about a third of the adult indigent criminal cases in your region. What percentage of your clients are incarcerated, at least at the beginning of your representation?
I don't have an exact number for you, though that's a great question, and we could run those numbers. It's significant. The attorney positions in the office are fit into two categories. What we're calling an assistant defender one, which are attorneys with about 5 or more years of experience in criminal defense work. And those attorneys are assigned more serious cases. So a very significant percentage of those two attorneys are taking cases where their clients are in custody. I would say for those two attorneys in the office, it's probably 75% of their case, their clients are in custody when we get them. The other two attorneys in the office are what are called assistant defender twos, and those are folks with less than 5 years of criminal defense experience. And so those attorneys are assigned more misdemeanors or low-level felonies. They're less likely to have their clients be in custody at the outset of the cases. They're more likely to have clients whose cases started with a walk-in arraignment or an initial appearance where they were not in custody. So we do have some for those folks also, but because we have that sort of experience gap there between those two different kinds of positions in the office, it's definitely weighted more heavily that incarcerated defendants are held, those cases are held by those assistant defender ones most of the time.
How important is it to a good attorney-client working relationship, especially in a public defender situation where it's not someone that was where the client went out and picked their attorney and hired them, to have good communication and face-to-face meetings?
It's huge, right? I mean, clients understandably want to know that someone cares about them, someone cares about their case, and someone is going to make time to learn about them and learn about their case. And there's no better way to communicate that than through a face-to-face meeting. And so we make it a real priority. Our internal goal is to meet with people within 7 days of getting their case. Now, sometimes that can be a challenge for various reasons, including where people are, whether they're in custody in pretrial detention or not, and where they're housed if they are in pretrial detention. So it's clearly very important to do that work and to have that face-to-face meeting and conversation. And the geography of pretrial detention doesn't always make that possible.
About that geography, what is the situation in Penobscot County with your incarcerated clients? I've been told that there's more incarcerated inmates on Penobscot County cases than the jail can hold, and that they have to board them out. Is that something that's happening in your cases? And how far away is the jail where they're then being held?
Yes, yes, and yes. There are more people unable to post pre-conviction bail in Penobscot County, especially when combined with the people serving jail sentences in Penobscot County. There are more people than can be detained in the Penobscot County Jail. It's quite a few more. I don't have today's numbers in front of me, but at any given time, it seems that there are somewhere between 20 and 50 folks being boarded at other facilities. The facilities where that boarding is taking place is primarily the Two Bridges Regional Jail, which is in Wiscasset. That's about a 2-hour
How
drive.
far is that? Sorry, you were about to answer that question. How far away is it?
2 hours. 2 hours there and 2 hours back.
So half a day
Half a day of
driving.
travel. Yep.
That sounds very efficient.
It's not. We also have clients in Cumberland County Jail, so that's even a little bit further, and in Somerset County Jail, which is about an hour. And we also have clients in Dover. So we have both Piscataquis County cases whose clients are detained in the Dover jail. And then we have Penobscot County cases where clients are boarded to the Dover jail. And that's about an hour also.
Okay. So not Dover, New Hampshire. That's what I usually think of when I hear that, because I'm in southern Maine.
I'm supposed to say Dover Foxcroft because they took two towns and turned them into one at some point, but it's hard for my brain.
So what does having a client, that's 2 hours away in jail do to your workflow and your representation for your attorneys?
Yeah, it makes it really challenging, right? It means that we, like you just pointed out, we have to take a half a day of travel time just to be able to go see that person. So we have to find a day for an attorney that is basically the entire day dedicated to that client meeting. And they might have an hour or change around the edges of that to get something else done. But between a 2-hour drive down there and then a client meeting, they want to do a lot in that client meeting. So it becomes a bit of a marathon because it's so hard to get there face to face. So it really puts a big impact on our capacity to have that long travel span in there.
I know that there is a lot of variation in the quality and availability and privacy of video our phone visits from jail to jail. Are video meetings at the Two Bridges Jail a realistic option if you're trying to do your job right?
Yeah, I mean, our experience is that they can be used to do an initial introduction. They're limited to 25 minutes. So that's 25 minutes max. If your client gets in front of the camera on time and the camera and the internet and everything else are working, you get 25 minutes with your client. Frequently, the jail staff don't tell the clients that they have these meetings. We have to call and remind them to put our clients in front of the video system for a meeting. So the meeting starts 10 or 15 minutes late, and that shrinks that meeting time pretty dramatically, pretty quickly. Frequently, the audio quality is quite bad. The video quality is not awesome. There's no capacity for sharing screens, so we can't show a client some of the discovery in their case or a piece of law or some work that we're doing on their case because we can't screen share using their system. And so it's pretty frustrating. It's a pretty frustrating way to try to communicate with clients, and it's very limited. You know, we are using it for quick things. If we have a quick update for a client, or like I said, to try to make that initial connection so that someone knows that we're there and we're working on their case early on in the appointment process.
And why is this happening? Why is there such a dramatic overcrowding issue in Penobscot County? Has the number of pending cases increased at a proportional rate to the number of incarcerated people, or is there a disconnect between the growth in pending criminal cases and the number of individuals being unable to make bail?
Well, I think it's both. The data from the Administrative Office of the Courts shows that we have something like 130% more open criminal cases in Penobscot County now than we did in 2019. Now, the state will tell you, the prosecutors will tell you, that's because we have a COVID backlog and we still haven't worked through all the COVID cases. I can tell you from looking at our docket that we have very few cases that are COVID backlog related. What we have is a ton of 2024 and 2025 cases. And those cases are clearly not COVID backlog cases. They're clearly current cases. So the fact that the number of open cases has gone up 130% in Penobscot County since 2019 is deeply disturbing. It begs the question, what is happening here that is causing there to be 130% more cases now than there were 6 years ago? And is the public any safer now than it was 6 years ago when we had 130% fewer open criminal cases? Now, of those cases, I don't know what the raw percentage is in terms of increase in jail. I will say that over the course of my career, over the 13 years of my career, I've seen cash bail amounts steadily climb. I think we're seeing higher cash bails now. And I also think we're seeing it, at least in an initial appearance, judges using cash bail implicitly or explicitly to prevent someone from being released, which is exactly what the bail code says they're not supposed to do. But when judges are nervous about someone getting out on bail, they'll set a cash bail that the person can't post. And they'll usually have a lawyer of the day tell them, this person can't post that bail, they will be detained. And the judges are deliberately setting cash bail amounts that they know an indigent person can't post in order to keep them in jail, despite that the bail code says they're not supposed to do that exact thing. So I think amount of cash bail, use of cash bail has increased, the amounts of cash bail have increased, and the willingness of the judiciary to set cash bail as a tool to keep someone in pre-conviction detention has increased, and that's part of what we're seeing.
We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, maybe we can talk about pretrial supervision and how, if implemented correctly, that can help address jail overcrowding. You're listening to Justice Radio with Rob Ruffner. And again, we're speaking with District Defender Logan Perkins. And now we're moving on to some questions about the relationship between or jail overcrowding as it affects Penobscot County and pretrial supervision programs. Logan, as you know, and the listeners may not know, but every county is required to have a pretrial supervision program by law. It doesn't really define it more than that, other than to say Each county shall have a pretrial supervision program. Most counties contract with, I believe the majority is Maine Pretrial throughout the state, but currently only two counties do not contract with a nonprofit that provides the services. Aroostook County and Somerset County are the two counties that have a county-based program, and both of them happen to be housed within the sheriff's department of those counties. What up until today was the current situation in Penobscot County?
So up until now-ish, Penobscot County has been using the same independent nonprofit service provider that's used in the other 14 counties in the state of Maine, which is what's called Maine Pretrial Services. Maine Pretrial Services is an independent nonprofit agency that has provided pretrial supervision screening and supervision contracts and services to folks all over the state of Maine for quite a while. I don't know the exact duration of their service provision, but they're in use in both
longer
countries.
Than we think. I think it began in the 80s initially.
Yeah, so Maine Pretrial has been providing that. And I think that they are currently supervising, my understanding is about 160 folks on pretrial supervision contracts. And some of those folks are on what we would call a deferred disposition or intermediate adjudicatory supervision between some sort of a plea and some sort of a sentencing outcome.
And that's just in your region, right?
That's just in our region. Sorry, it's about 130, not about a. I don't know what I said before, about 130. Maine Pretrial has been offering those services. They meet with people on a regular basis. They have regular call-in requirements. In some cases, they're permitted to request drug or alcohol testing. In some cases, they're required to supervise somebody getting into counseling or something of that effect. They're doing that work of making sure that people who are out on bail are taking steps to address a compliance with the bail code, which includes not committing new crimes, not posing a danger to the community, and appearing for court as ordered.
And has there been a change in Penobscot County recently?
Yes. Well, so Penobscot County Sheriff has just decided that he no longer wishes to contract Maine Pretrial Services to provide the service. And so what we know at this point is that he's terminating that contract, that Maine Pretrial is no longer going to be providing services in Penobscot County, and that his plan, as far as we can tell, is to take that responsibility in-house in the sheriff's department. And so that the county sheriff, through some internal division, would take over pretrial supervision for folks. So for about 130 folks currently on contract, and that they would take over the responsibility for that, for employees of the sheriff's department to do that work.
So, you know, Maine Pretrial and other organizations like Maine Pretrial, they follow the best practices that have been developed nationally. They use reviewed and tested screening criteria when they do their intakes to determine not only is someone an appropriate risk to supervise in the community, but what provisions in their contract ought to be required so that the risk is lower, whether that's in-person check-in, counseling, curfews, and that sort of thing. And they're independent. Their job is to be accurate and get it right. They don't work for the clients. They don't work for the court. They don't work for the prosecutors. What model has the sheriff said that he's going to be following?
Well, we don't really know. I think one of the things he is saying is that he's looking at the Aroostook County model to try to implement some of the features of the Aroostook County model here. I don't have any clarity, including I don't know what the hell this thing's going to be called. I don't know what he's going to name his program, how we're going to refer to it, or what the shape of it is going to look like at this point. So I think in the next couple of months here, on a pretty short time frame, we're going to have to learn a lot about this. And that's pretty concerning to me from where I sit, because having not any information about it, I'm concerned about some core principles that are evolving here, but also that it doesn't bode well for consistency for our clients or fairness for our clients. And I have a feeling we're in for a little bit of chaos.
Will the free trial supervision program in Penobscot County be independent of the law enforcement function of the sheriff's department? And who will these people report to?
That's a great question. And I don't know the answer. I mean, by design, it seems like they're going to be reporting ultimately to the sheriff. So that suggests the answer is no, it's not going to be independent of a law enforcement function. And I think that's one of the concerns about this proposal to shift from an independent agency like Maine Pretrial to the Sheriff's Department. You know, Maine Pretrial, the people they hire to do the supervision come from social work backgrounds, right? So they come from a background that is like, how do we take these people who are not guilty, right? Under the law, all of the people in pretrial detention are not guilty. And how do we provide them the services and support they need to participate in the process of their criminal case, to be out on bail, to show up for court, and to stay safe in the community while those things happen? The Sheriff's Department is going to come at this from a law enforcement perspective. And you don't have to do criminal defense law for very long to learn pretty quickly that most law enforcement and most prosecutors assume that everyone is guilty, despite the command of our Constitution, which is to presume innocence. And so it's very concerning to me that this kind of pre-trial, not guilty, presumption of innocence supervision is going to land in a law enforcement agency who assumes everyone's guilt.
Has the sheriff given any reasons for why he's making this decision?
Yes.
Has he expressed any complaint? Oh, what are those?
He's given two reasons. One reason is financial. He has indicated that he's hoping he can implement a plan that will have a pay-to-play feature. In other words, that in order to have a supervision contract with the sheriff's department, folks will have to make some sort of monthly or weekly financial contribution to that supervision. And so he thinks it will save him money because the net cost will come down when you have indigent, not guilty folks paying to be free.
Is he expecting all the defense attorneys at initial appearances to fall asleep at the wheel and not say that noise and object to any contract that has a financial component for an indigent person? Or is he just expecting the court to go along with that?
I think he's going to propose a sliding scale cost. And I think he is expecting that both the court and the defense bar will be so excited to have this opportunity to get their people out on bail. One of the problems with the pay model is that we see on a regular basis, we see indigent clients commit to financial obligations that they can't afford because of the inherently coercive nature of the system. So we see clients—
That never leads to a cascade of failures and further bad decisions in an attempt to meet those financial obligations, does it?
It pretty much always leads to a cascade of failures.
Right.
And what it amounts to is it amounts to debtor's prison, right? It amounts to a situation where someone can't meet their financial obligations, whether it's to pay for a pretrial supervision contract, and so they end up back in jail, or whether it's to pay a fine that they've agreed to a fine payment plan on, and so they end up back in jail. There's a misconception, I think, in the general public that in the United States, we don't have debtor's prisons. But the reality is that our criminal justice system shuttles a massive amount of wealth from the poorest people in our communities into the general fund of the state coffers on a regular basis. If you sit and watch walk-in arraignments someday, what you see is poor people standing up to say over and over and over again, guilty, I'll pay a fine, and it'll take me, you know, 6 months to pay this $300 fine in monthly increments. And then they actually are ending up paying more than that between the fees and surcharges that are applied. And they're likely to miss a payment, and they're likely to have a warrant issue, and they're likely to get arrested. And we end up shuffling significant funds from people who can't afford a lawyer, but end up offering to pay the state for their alleged misdeeds to get it over with so that they don't have to miss work or find childcare or whatever it is, simply to show up to court and deal with the allegations against them.
What is the second reason that the sheriff has put forth?
I'm so glad you asked. The second reason he has said he wants to take control of this is because Maine Pretrial is either unwilling or understands that legally they cannot inspect people's homes. And he would like the power to inspect people's homes when they are on pretrial supervision contracts. He would like...
Is he smoking crack?
I mean, I think what he's done is roll up the Fourth Amendment and light that on fire like it's a... Like it's a joint and he's maybe smoking that, which I think that paper was made from hemp. So it's not crap.
Okay. I'm assuming that there are budgetary issues in the Penobscot County Sheriff's Office in having officers to conduct bail checks, extrajudicial bail checks, if they're not ordered as bail conditions by a judge. And in jurisdictions where there are law police departments, I don't know that Bangor Police Department is going to take kindly to the Sheriff's Office doing bail checks in Bangor. There's certain parts of the county which are, where the sheriff's office is the law enforcement agency, but much of the county has its own police departments. Again, I go back to if he is consuming something in large quantities that may be affecting his judgment. Is that another way for him saying, I know these people shouldn't be out, and if we just dug around their dirty laundry enough, we'd find more ways to get them back in my jail? I mean,
Well,
essentially.
that's a great question, right? And it sure seems that way, right? Because it sure seems like it's designed to require not guilty people to waive their Fourth Amendment right to privacy in their home and to submit to searches of their home to purportedly ensure their compliance with bail conditions. Now, in reality, what that sounds like to me is an end run around the warrant requirement and a presumption of guilt. And it just feels like we know that the Fourth Amendment doesn't support random searches of your person, much less of your house. So the house is the most sacrosanct, most protected, most inviolable entity that we have under the Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, right? The Fourth Amendment says your home is the most sacred thing that law enforcement should have to meet the highest burden in order to invade and search. And typically that's only done through warrants. So it's only done through judicial review. And you're right, this proposal sounds an awful lot like the sheriff thinking that he's going to skip judicial review and just give his deputies the ability to go search anyone's house. You know, I admire your faith in Bangor Police Department to object to a jurisdictional problem here. I don't think that's going to happen. I think they're going to be stoked
Well,
about it.
I don't think they'll make a big stink of it, but they'll wonder why the sheriff's department is doing law enforcement in their own jurisdiction. But it seems like this is a completely law enforcement perspective instead of the purposes of pretrial supervision, which is to re reduce pretrial incarceration levels while maintaining safety, and that's what they're trained to do. That it is going to exacerbate the overcrowding problem that he is complaining about and needing, calling for an expansion of his jail, and really calls into question, a reasonable bail provisions of our bail code in the Constitution. And so I wish we were not running out of time because I have many questions. And so I think perhaps we can have you back in a couple months when we've seen how this develops and whether there are or are not any further answers or justifications and how this plays out. I want to thank you, Logan, for being here. Thank you for listening to Justice Radio. Tune in next time where we may have someone to talk more about pretrial services or an update on the developments in Penobscot County. A big thank you to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each of our episodes in our series. Thank you for listening to Justice Radio, where everything is off the record.